Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2022 podcast series.
Good afternoon, Neera Dumaring, everyone. Welcome to the Melbourne Writers Festival. We respectfully acknowledge today that we're meeting on the lands of the Kulin Nations, in particular Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung peoples, and pay our respects to their elders past and present and elders of all communities and cultures across Victoria. I'd also like to acknowledge any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people joining us in the audience today. My name's Janine Lane and I belong to the Wurundjeri peoples of southwestern New South Wales. It's with great pleasure that I'm here today to speak to two wonderful poets and writers of our First Nations community. I have here Michaela Saunders, who is a Koori and Lebanese writer from the Tweed region, and Michaela will elaborate a little more about herself in the course of the discussion, and Evelyn Araluen, Bundjalung writer, who will also speak a little more about herself during the conversation. So we're here today to talk about memory work, and so I'll just launch straight in and I will ask Evelyn first. How do you define memory work, Evelyn?
Thank you, and also extending my acknowledgements, my respect and my reverence for the Kulin Nations and for their ongoing custodianship and sovereignty of this country, and also to, you know, extend my reverence to be able to share the stage with two incredible black women here today. We actually kind of went through a little bit of a process of thinking about this panel quite early on and about the specific terminology. And I think it was you who sort of really pinned down memory work, and that immediately resonated, I think, for a few different reasons with myself and Michaela. Certainly just speaking for myself, it is obviously something that I've witnessed in the work of incredible black writers such as yourself. Natalie Harkin as well particularly does a lot with this broader field or idea of docu-poetry, archival poetics, broader ideas of refusal that involve speaking back to the archives and speaking back to the kind of the documents and infrastructure of the settler colony that continue to control and textualize the lives of Aboriginal people. And in contrast to that, or rather kind of like working alongside that practice of refusal, retaliation, even kind of practices of haunting and hauntology, you also see this incredible work of remembering and reminding. And that's something that, again, you've written on in terms of gathering and the way that, you know, the stories of and practices of gathering in your family continue to inform the way that you work creatively and in a kind of scholarly capacity as well with research. So it resonated with me in the sense of what I'm already seeing out there being done in this particular space and work that informs my own practice. And additionally, shouting out Alison Whitaker, who does a lot with similar kinds of projects of colonial refusal and archival practices, and also for her emphasis on work. You know, her last collection was called Black Work, which was a big part of that, was reminding us about the labour of refusal, the labour of reinscription and reminding. And so, you know, I think memory work opens us up to broader possibilities that are not necessarily always forcing a constant relationship to the colonial in the way that archival sometimes can, or can, you know, there's a kind of closure implied there where we're only really speaking on the various ways in which the colony has silenced us. But the memory work is something broader, I think. It's something that allows that allows, you know, blackfellas to reclaim those associations, those relations, that ancestral knowledge and its continued practice and manifestation in our lives. That is just, to me, so much more empowering. So I love some of the archival docu-poetic work. But yeah, I think memory works, that terminology is just so much more open than some of those other frames. So I dig it.
Thanks. What about you, Michaela?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with what Evelyn said. I think the focus of memory work is to talk about memory and remembrance and honouring that on our own terms, our cultural terms. So not just, you know, using the colonisers' archives and using the colonisers' records, which is still an important part because many of us have those interferences in our family histories and it's important to reclaim them and to speak back to them the way, you know, Natalie Harkin has done and many other people, but, you know, famously Natalie Harkin. But it's bigger than that. It's oral histories as well. I did my master's thesis on transgenerational trauma and healing in my community and I spoke to five women in my community, people I'm related to, and we created this kind of meta-narrative where we talked about our relationships to country and culture, family. And the focus wasn't just on trauma, it was also on healing and strength and humour and all those beautiful things that we know exist. But if we listen to other people's accounts of us, you would never think that they exist because you would think it's all heavy, horrible trauma. Anyway, so, yeah, memory work, I think we are naturally culturally inclined to it, and not just writers, any kind of artists or academics or storytellers, you know, culturally, you know, when you want to compare us to the Australian culture or lack thereof, we bring our past with us. We live our past. We don't forget our old people. The way Australian time or Western time works is they try to distance themselves from the past and they try to put space between us, but we're always bringing it with us. And I think memory work, the way we do it is really important act of, you know, sovereignty, and especially in storytelling, because in contrast, the Australian colonial project has been, it's been a project of forgetting work or making us try to forget, because, you know, if we remember, then they have to, you know, have some kind of ethics or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Memory sits outside all institutions, I think. Yeah. So, yeah, but sticking with you, Michaela, and you sort of touched on it, how do you do memory in your own writing?
I think it's just always been natural to me. Like, I'm new to this writing stuff, but I think just growing up in a family and a community who've always told stories, who've always remembered together, yeah, it's just a natural extension. You know, I've never written anything thinking that it's like the first or the best. I'm always drawing on my own experiences, which are not individual experiences. They're collective and communal experiences because I share them with people, I share them with our people. And, yeah, I guess everything I write, whether it's a story or an essay or a thesis or whatever, I think it's really important to contextualise yourself, you know, in the history of your family, your community, the wider society. So I wrote an essay in this new collection called Against Disappearance, out now. It's a Liminal and Pantera Press anthology. And it's the theme of these essays is the archive. And a few years ago, I found a collection of my uncle's poetry written in the Courier Mail in the 90s, and it was a surprise to me. I was very close to him. I didn't really know about this. And I've been working on a project at the moment wherein I'm, with each of these 12 poems, I'm writing a letter to him and I'm writing poetry in response to his own. So that is probably the most explicit memory work I'm doing because I'm in conversation with my passed away uncle who I still have a relationship with and I'm still tending to those memories and, yeah.
Yeah. Evelyn's wearing a great T-shirt that does a lot of memory work. So how else do you do it, Evelyn?
I think a big part of memory and emphasising the work here of this configuration involves the kind of active participation in the spaces in which the things that we wish to remember occur. So we've got quite complex histories, I think, in this country as a result of the ongoing structures of invasion, but also of the subsequent conservative governments and settler colonial infrastructures that have been developed to reduce our capacity to remember, to speak for those memories, and to continue to keep those voices in our, you know, in our awareness, and to continue to learn from them. So the work that I've attempted to kind of do, that I attempted to do in Drop Bear, like a big part of that was mostly just about trying to articulate a particular positionality that I have towards the artifacts of the settler colony, and to make my discomfort with that visible, and to also make visible the people who were involved in articulating that to me. So my parents, my dad in particular, this is his shirt. I sort of, you know, might have stolen it, I don't know. But this is, Janine was just saying that she thinks that it probably actually would have been made around in the lead up to the
1987.
Yeah, to the bicentenary protests and such. I know it was from Redfern, and I know that Dad was involved with a lot of collectives and Aboriginal organisations. And, you know, I chose to wear it today because, you know, today is an important day in terms of the death of the colony, the slow eventual death of the colony. And I wanted to remember. What that survival looks like in the daily inhabited ways and informed ways that we as Aboriginal people continue to live our lives. And so there's things I can answer that question about regarding, like, my creative, probably more so my critical work. But I think if that work is not aligned with a kind of daily lived practice of continuing to be black in the settler colony, then it's not necessarily that divorce from the meaning that comes from our families and our communities and the various ways in which we continue to care for our countries. That's a product of settler coloniality, and we need to be in a constant state of refusal and response to that. So I try to, as much as possible, place my dad and place the mandates of my family in my awareness and take guidance from that. And now, as my work kind of shifts a little bit back to the critical, and for a while I'm going to be not really focusing that much on writing poetry, but focusing more on projects in this sort of scholarly space about memory, about reminding. You know, we've been working on this. Janine has been involved with me on organising this project about gathering together the hidden histories and silent stories of Australian publishing, scholarship and media. And I'm really excited to actually bring people together to start talking about that, because we have this huge issue with the overemphasis of the new and emerging in this country, and that often is, too often, it's about the young and emerging, and that's a real problematic narrative, because in our culture it's elders who hold knowledge and wisdom and who should be given the strongest capacity to speak. But because of the market and the commercial forces of a settler colonial market, they're either not getting heard or their pathway is not sustainable. Like, we don't have the proper infrastructure to sustain mid-career writers, particularly not mid-career black writers, particularly not those who want to stay in their communities. And so we're working on this project to try to talk about some of the women, particularly on focusing on women who, you know, they never got invited to festivals like this. They never got the kinds of spaces that they deserved in that. So I think for me, my priority is focusing on the work, reminding myself of the work that's already been done and seeking mandate from that, and not from, or trying to not seek mandate from a settler colonial commercial market that wants certain stories at certain times but doesn't want to sustain the people that helped build the communities that those stories come from.
Yeah, like history. That history is not what happens, is just what is recorded, and in a settler colony that is not much, and only memory can counter that. But Evelyn's comments lead me to my next suggestion, which was, you know, no work ever grows out of an individual moment. It grows out of a momentum. Hey, would you like to say something about that now?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My kind of big obsession is speculative fiction, First Nations speculative fiction. I edited an anthology this year called This All Come Back Now. Evelyn's story opens it. Janine wrote a blurb for it, so it's all very cosy up here. I'm so obsessed with speculative fiction. I started writing my own in 2017 as part of my Doctor of Arts degree. Before then, I'd never written any. I didn't really know much of what of our own stuff that was out there. I'd read the Swan book and I loved it. That's all I really knew. That was my starting point. Over the 4 and a bit years that I did my thesis on this, I sought out every single First Nations speculative fiction, whether it was TV like Clever Man or novels or short stories. I also did this kind of dead end thing where I sought out every white written speculative fiction that featured at least one Aboriginal character. Most of it was so bad, and I just, yes, that's why it was a dead end. Anyway, so in this process of trying to figure out, you know, I want to write speculative fiction. I want to write stories set in my community in the future. I needed to know what kind of tradition I was writing into, because I knew I wasn't the first. I knew I wasn't the best. Sometimes there is a problem in any community, really, but, you know, I've seen some people claim to be the first Aboriginal speculative fiction writer, or I've seen others claim someone else to be, and it's just not true, you know. Our first speculative fiction novel was published in 1990. It's called The Kadaitcha Sung by Sam Watson, who was a very staunch Mananjali activist and author. And when that book came out, nobody knew what to do with it, because it still is very weird. You know, but in the 90s, we had a few of our writers writing this, and more were writing it. And so, yeah, to answer your question, when you're writing into something, or you want to be part of a tradition, it's very, very important to see what's done before, to be able to locate your own work and to be in conversation with it too. Because if you think you're writing this like amazing new thing, I guarantee you some of our people have done it before, and probably a lot more nuanced and cheekier ways than you. So that's what I wanted to do. And in my anthology, I included an excerpt of Sam Watson's, with permission of his family. We included excerpts of Alexis Wright's The Swan Book, Ellen Van Nier, you know, just some of the more, what I would consider canonical First Nations spec fic, alongside some of the new and exciting stuff that does often get fetishised, as Evelyn rightly says. I think it's important when you're working on a project like that to bring all of the stuff in rather than try and be the first or the best, you know.
Yeah. And the anthology is such an important force in that. And, you know, that's something that really, like, there is such a long history, an unrecognized, largely unrecognized history of anthologies, particularly coming from, you know, like local community anthologies that might have been put together from like a writers group or from even like smaller family networks. And we've actually got such a rich and diverse history of those works that, again, they're not situated or celebrated in the same way in the market, in the publishing landscape, because Euro-Western literary traditions want to seek to emphasise the individual, and they don't want to emphasise the collaborative work that comes from a community, and particularly not from marginalised communities. So there's been some really beautiful work on the importance of anthologies in Pacifica literatures that I learnt a lot from, that I would love to see carried and asserted in an Australian context, just with so much more energy, because it's really up to us kind of now to be doing that while that's in memory, like your connection to your uncle being able to guide you back to those poems and to re-center them. That's the sort of work that we do all have to kind of take an individual responsibility for, because the publishing landscape isn't going to do us any favours here, you know. And it's funny you bring up the Kadaitcha Sung. I got my copy of that through a very specific set of circumstances. I'd been having this knockdown argument with my department, which I'm not going to name, but you could work it out.
I know who it is.
Yeah. you know, they were. I was furious about the lack of inclusion of Black literature on the curriculum. You know, simultaneously we were having our Koori Centre demolished, and you know, I'd gone in trying to study Indigenous studies, Koori studies as it was called back then, and I was losing that in front of my eyes, and it was pushed into the English department where they didn't have Black texts. And I remember one professor in particular was like, well, you know, there really only is one good novel and that's out of print. Oh. And the novel he was referring to is the Kadacha-san. Oh. I got my copy when the department had their throwout of spare books. It was signed by Sam Watson to that professor. So he criticised that. You know, he said, we can't include this, it's not in print, but he got rid of his own signed copy of it, which just shows you that this is not a proper sense of valuation. He, as an academic, as a very well-respected, established academic at a very influential institution, could have reached out to the publishers and said, hi, we really need this to be back in print. I need to take some responsibility and ensure that a new generation of readers are encountering this. But nobody wants to take responsibility when they could go the much easier route of going for something that does half of the work. That,
new and shiny.
Yeah, new and shiny. And that's something we all need to take responsibility for, because I let myself be new and shiny for years, and it was a really...
But you were young and shiny, you didn't know.
Yeah, well, you know, if I'd spent time thinking about it. But, you know, and it is really disheartening to see it happen in front of your eyes, where you know that people are getting left out, and you know that they're incredible people who, if they'd gotten a scrap of the opportunities that the younger generation has access to, would have been able to do astounding, astounding things. And the history of anthologies plays a key role in that, because it's going back to those and actually tracking down the names and tracking down all of these voices that might have written one completely astounding essay. You know, I found Jennifer Martiniello's work, this one gorgeous essay by this absolute genius.
Jennifer Camara Martiniello, who is also a visual artist. So check out their visual art, particularly their woven glass eel traps.
Yeah, and I had no idea she wrote.
She wrote that beautiful westerly essay. Is that the one you're talking about?
Avoids Voices and Story Without
yes.
End.
Oh.
And that changed my brain.
Yeah.
That essay taught me things that have just not only have made me a better poet and a better scholar, but also it wound things together for me in terms of culture and language in such an important and influential way. And if we've been touched by that, it is, I think, up to us to ensure that that has a place and that we advocate as much as we do create in the space. You know, it's about giving exactly as much as has been given to you, I think, is the only way that, you know, this generation of Black writers can proceed respectfully. And that's why I think it was so great that, you know, you've been sitting on incredible works of your own, but you chose to centre an anthology before you allowed yourself to be configured as the individual author, which is something that, like, I have endless respect for you for doing, because I think that was a crucial thing to do at this very time and right now. That was a great way of intervening in some of the more insidious practices in the industry at the moment.
Yeah, thanks. Just before I go on to the next question, there's a couple of really seminal anthologies that came out in the 90s that don't get talked about enough now, in particular Those Who Remain Remember by the late, great and very unsung Auntie Rosemary Vandenberg, Inside Black Australia by the late Uncle Kevin Gilbert, and Paperbark, an anthology of Black writing edited by the late Uncle Jack Davis and published by the University of Queensland Press. And because you mentioned Auntie Jenny Camara Martiniello, an incredible writer, but also left the writing scene and chose to focus on visual arts because of ageism.
Yeah, that's And this is what happens.
And this is what happens.
Can I also add, there's the Dreaming Inside series where, you know, inmates in at Junee Prison, I think it is, they've been writing Junee their poetry
jail.
And they've been actually one of my cousins was was in one of them. So I wasn't even the first.
Yeah.
I wasn't the first published poet in my family. But, yeah, you know, these are anthologies going to spaces with people who are not going to be published through conventional channels, and I think that's really important.
Yeah.
Because so many of our people are locked up, you know.
That's Dreaming on the Inside.
That's
that
right.
Anthology is Dreaming on the Inside, edited by Uncle Bruce Pascoe and the incredible, also unsung, Auntie Barbara Nicholson.
Yes.
Wadi Wadi Elder.
And also the last one to emphasise again is your friend Annie Carey and Kerry Reid Gilbert and all
the late Annie Carey Reid Gilbert. Yep. Whose back was used as a bridge for many people to cross to their success and needs to be acknowledged more. How do you see the work of memory? And what role does that play in the present moment? I'll throw that open to either of you.
It's absolutely so important. I wrote an essay for Sydney Review of Books for their Writing Gender series. We had a Zoom webinar about it today, so it's very fresh in my head. But, you know, I particularly talk about there's an incredible Darrumbull and South Sea Islander journalist, Amy McGuire.
Yeah.
And she has a methodology of presencing. And because she works in media and she's so frustrated with how white media ignore us and lie about us, her method of presencing, which is a verb, it's an active doing, you know, it's not passive at all. It's a way that we can, well, it's a way that she, but anyone else can kind of, you know, use it. We can actively centre our stories, our experiences, our missing and murdered people, people who are being forgotten. I don't like saying voiceless because no one's voiceless. It's just maybe platformless.
Silenced.
Maybe. Yeah, silenced, erased. And memory work, I think, is very broad. You know, anyone in the arts or academia or just even in your own family and community can do it. This act of presencing and making sure stories and people aren't forgotten. Yeah, I think if we don't do it, if we don't speak back against our kind of forced silence and erasure, then Australia, well, white Australia gets to control the narrative about us. And, you know, we won't have that. We'll never have that. We never have had that. And I think today we have more and more people writing, more of us writing, more of us doing art, more of us doing these things that are presencing our memories and doing this memory work that we're talking about. But, yeah, I think there's right ways and there's not so right ways to do it. I know you were going to ask a question about this, but I might just talk about it now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was thinking about, because Janine sent us these questions and they were so great. I started writing essays about them, you know, really got me thinking. And I was thinking about the fact that, you know, there are some people doing memory work or they're telling Aboriginal stories, you know, and I don't necessarily always get the motivations because I think to do memory work properly, you have to have a relationship to the stories that you're dealing in. You know, whether you work in academia or visual arts or you're writing poetry or, you know, essays or whatever it is. Because if you don't have a relationship to these stories that you're putting out there, it's like Chelsea Wadigo says in Another Day in the Colony, you're only benefiting yourself and white audiences and white institutions. So you have to really question who these stories are for, who you're writing for, who you're putting them out there for. And if, you know, if you're putting stories out there that you don't have a connection to, you're not going to do it well. There's going to be other people there who are going to do it better, with more accuracy, with more truth. And, yeah, you just shouldn't do it, I guess, is my summary.
Yeah, it's quite, you know, just because something happens in for one Aboriginal community, it's not everyone's story.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
You said it much more concisely than me.
So Janine wrote, can you talk a little bit actually, because you've written about presencing yourself as well in a few contexts, and I know you wrote about it in your PhD as well, which was about really providing like an extensive archival documentary kind of structure of revealing Aboriginal erasure and presence in the canon of colonial literature and some frameworks to think through refusals in that. And then that was a through line as well, because shout out to Overland for a moment, but Janine has written an incredible series of essays.
No longer malleable stuff.
No longer malleable stuff, other people's stories. And there is, I believe we'll have another one ideally on extending that series, but presencing is a continued framework for you, not simply just in making visible Aboriginal presence in the settler colonial narratives of violence and exclusion, but also in the commercial and scholarly structures that attend to that. So I reckon you've got a better answer for that question than what we can have.
Oh, just briefly, because I don't want to take time up on the panel, but yeah, I was bouncing off actually something that Martin Heidegger said about a border or a boundary is you can tell where it ends, not by a line in the sand or any physical kind of presence, but when something else threatens it. When something, you don't know where a border or a boundary is until something gets too close to it. And we feel that all the time in a settler colonial setting when we're getting too close, and you can tell that by the reception of our work. And particularly I was thinking about memory work and the reception of the earliest work of print literature, not Aboriginal literature per se, if you think about oral story, but print literature, was the late and great Ujiru Nunukul, publishing then under her name Kath Walker. And the reception that that got was just shocking, you know, people comparing it to circus fleas or, you know. But then that kind of critique of our work in a way hasn't really moved on that much since 1964. Some of the language is a bit more couched. And so, you know, you can tell when we're getting too close to a heartland or to a border or to a boundary that is set up by Western civilization when you feel the reaction of it. So, yeah, I've got an essay forthcoming in a Cambridge volume, which is taking forever to come out. Like Cambridge, like, you know, like the Cambridge tradition. But, yeah, it's called presencing. But, yeah, it's a good term because it deals with a non-compartmentalisation of times, like all times are important and no time is resolved. I was going to ask, because I was thinking Michaela wrote an essay for the Sydney Review of Books just recently, which was particularly addressing deficit myths of First Nations people. And in that, I was thinking about how do you use the past and memory to address the present or the present mythscape of settlerism. And so, you know, I might ask Michaela if you just bounce off that more recent essay.
Yeah, I mean, I could read a bit because I think it speaks for itself. Like, I'll read a bit just for a couple of minutes. So, I'm gonna read near the end. So, for context, I was helping out a neighbour a few years ago fleeing a domestic violence situation, and it brought up a lot of my own personal and family history, and as I'm helping her, she says something a little bit racist to me in my own home. So, though I'm sitting right in front of her, Lisa prefers her third-hand knowledge of Aboriginal dysfunction. To her, I'm just an anomaly that doesn't fit her paradigm, as she locates authenticity elsewhere, in other, blacker, more remote and violent and spiritual Aboriginal people. Tonight, Lisa has drawn from and contributed to a much larger fiction of Aboriginal dysfunction that has been told over centuries. In the first chapter of Another Day in the Colony, Chelsea Wadigo, which won the People's Choice Awards of the Queensland Literary Festival last night, she talks of a way that colonial and contemporary authorities have storied our dysfunction over time, and she provides dozens of examples and other evidence. But one piece of evidence that I would like to contribute to this yarn, a gendered piece, comes from historian Margarita Stevens, who reminds us that in 1997, Pauline Hanson republished Daisy Bates's testimony about infanticide and maternal cannibalism, despite it being long discredited, end quote. Pauline Hanson has built her entire grotty career off colonial fictions about us, and in doing so, she has firmed those fictions up. Bates's testimony, along with many other so-called impartial records written by colonisers, have been foundational to these fictions, the very same fictions that inspired the politicians who orchestrated the Northern Territory emergency response. John Howard, Marlborough, Amanda Vanstone and others too consulted bunk records about us and counterfeited their own in the form of the Little Children are Sacred Report, a process which justified the government's racist and abusive occupation of Aboriginal countries and communities. These people too, in building upon existing fictions about us, amplified and perpetuated our people's supposed dysfunction as a whole, but also in gendered ways as parents and as partners. I'll leave it there, yeah. So, basically, yes. The storying of our dysfunction has been going on since the beginning of colonisation, and it's not in the past, it's not of the past, it's of all times, it's including this time. The reason that I suspect, and it's from reading work by yourself and other scholars about the importance of stories. The reason that they have been able to get away with so much and to convince others to get away with so much is by convincing them that we're subhuman, that we're animals, that we don't deserve rights, that we eat our own children, that we are violent, that we practice black magic, that we need saving, all of these horrible things, and they all originate in story. And it's with story that they have to be battled, and that's where memory work comes in.
Thanks. Hey, I forgot to tell you that Michaela won the David Unipon Award last night at the...
Thank you. Speaking of some as somebody who won it many years ago with Purple Threads.
Yeah. Thank you. And on, you know, just an example of presencing, I mean, I'm loath to raise it, but sometimes you have to get sick to get better, right? So Steve Price and Andrew Bolt lamenting the demise of the white man, of the white male. I don't know if you've seen any of that, but if you haven't, just briefly have a look and purge. you know, that is an example of presencing, like they're really feeling that. Would you like to read something?
I was kind of, as you were speaking before, there was something rattling around my head that I was trying to find, not of my own writing, but there's an essay by Eve Tuck and C. Ree that continues to inspire and continues to really guide my own thought processes. And really the whole essay is just an extraordinary document of that kind of hauntological memory work practice and refusal. And I continue to learn quite a lot from it. Many people are aware of Eve Tuck and Kay Wayne Yang's essay, Decolonization is Not a Metaphor, which I think should kind of be like a foundational, like a keystone of the way that we talk about decolonisation globally, but particularly in a currently ongoing Commonwealth settler colonial state. But I wanted to briefly actually read from that essay because, to be perfectly honest, I think if we're not all sick of listening to Drop Bear by now, we should be. So I'm not going to read my own stuff. So this is from a section called Desire. So this is called the essay is called The Glossary of Haunting, and the logic of The Glossary of Haunting is that it actually appears without a host document. It's a glossary to something which is missing. And I was inspired by that and wrote several paratextual documents in Drop Bear, like appendices and such, that were of a similar kind of project of writing something without needing to feel like I'm restaging the central thing that I'm refusing. So this is from the section on Desire by Eve Tuck and Kay Wayne Yang. I am invited to speak, but only when I speak my pain. Instead, I speak of desire. Desire is a refusal to trade in damage. Desire is an antidote, a medicine to damage narratives. Desire, however, is not just living in the looking glass. It isn't a trip to opposite world. Desire is not a light switch, not a nescient turn to focus on the positive. It is a recognition of suffering, the costs of settler colonialism and capitalism, and how we still thrive in the face of loss anyway, the parts of us that won't be destroyed. When I write or speak about desire, I am trying to get out from underneath the ways that my communities and I are always depicted. I insist on telling stories of desire, of complexity, of irrigation, of promising myself one thing at night and doing another in the morning. Desire is what we know about ourselves, and damage is what is attributed to us by those who wish to contain us. Desire is complex and complicated. It is constantly reformulating and does so by extinguishing itself, breaking apart, reconfiguring, recasting. Desire licks its own fingers, bites its own nails, swallows its own fist. Desire makes itself its own ghost, creates itself from its own remnants. Desire, in its making and remaking, bounds into the past as it stretches into the future. It is productive, it makes itself, and in making itself, it makes reality.
So from here on in, how do you see your responsibilities in this, in memory work?
Well, I think if you identify as an Aboriginal writer or artist or whatever, I think you have an utmost responsibility to your own community. I think it was Evelyn, you had a metaphor about a river overtaking port. Was it you, Jeanette? Sorry, I can't remember who said it.
I don't know about a river, but definitely the logic that you have to give back exactly
right,
what
okay.
you give. Yeah, I love that your brain went to water for that.
It's a metaphor I've used. River. I've heard it used actually. The Wiradjuri artist Naretha Williams, who I've worked with a few years ago, I heard her first explain that culture is a river and we take from it, but we also have to give back. And so as an Aboriginal artist, if you're just taking, if you're just using that label to get work, to sell stories, to get on panels, what are you giving back? And I don't just mean to the white literary community, but to your own communities. And if you don't have a community, well, that's something you have to work on before you, I think, become an Aboriginal storyteller, you know, because as I talked about before, who are your stories benefiting? Who are you writing these for? Are you writing to get famous? And I know I'm focusing very much on, you know, I'm being critical of Aboriginal writers and work and stuff, but I'm allowed to be because I work in this space. And I think when you see flaws, when you see things that are doing damage to us and to our integrity, the integrity of our stories and our cultures, we need to be able to talk about them. And we do talk amongst ourselves, yes, but we need to be able to talk about them publicly because, you know, let's face it, the majority of people who are programming, publishing, platforming are white people. So everybody needs to be aware of this stuff, you know. There's obviously stuff I won't talk about or perform in public, but these are really important things to me as an Aboriginal writer. You know, all of my work, my creative work, my scholarly work, everything has been rooted in my community because they are who grew me up. They are who taught me. They are who growled at me when I stuff up. They are who are very proud of me if I do something great, you know. And I'm always thinking about how to get our stories out there, have our stories known. And that could be stories from the past, but it's also stories of the future too, you know. I'm always thinking about, you know, my short story collection, which will be published next year, all these stories are set in my community in the future, in different versions of the future, because I wanted to centre our people and our own political structures and our own responses to climate change and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, to assert a value beyond that which is dictated by the marketplace.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I was raised by blackfellas, but crucially also raised by blackfellas who worked in public education, in public service. Mm-hmm. And that's something, you know, and you, as also did Jeanine, and I think that that, you know, when I listen to you talk and I listen to my dad talk, there are just so many similar value systems there that only come from actually working in spaces where you are constantly at the interface of the violent colonial regime of, you know, the government education departments and the expectations that they require you as somebody working at that interface, and the capacity to influence young people and to improve systems and structures as much as possible. And, you know, I try to take what I've learnt from, you know, from people like yourself, Janine, from my dad, and particularly from older people in the community as well, who have persisted in their presencing and persisted in their acts of reminding, which recognising that as something that operates very differently in black spaces, because a lot of black fellas do not get to come into these spaces until much later in their lives. And I'm really proud of work that I have done and grateful for opportunities that I've had, but I have also witnessed the way that I got to excel in things that, you know, my dad's also a writer, and he's been working really hard for years, decades, on trying to write a history of the frontier, you know, of the frontier wars in on Darug country and Burrabrongal country where he lives. And he has had nowhere near the same accessibility and opportunity as I've had. And not only am I in a position to be able to try to improve those conditions, being, you know, his daughter who has the email addresses of publishers I can harass, but I also have a day job, several, but one of which is that I'm the co-editor of Overland Literary Journal. And the last couple of years, we've been working on strategy and we've been working on funding and fixing our website and all of these kinds of boring things. But they're so important and crucial, particularly if an organisation is committed to progressive values and to trying to be a positive force in a very negative and cynical literary marketplace. So, you know, as I kind of wind down some of the other things that I've been trying to, you know, do in my life, like my PhD for the last 7 years, it's something, yeah, hopefully I'll get it done. Well, Michaela finished yours very recently.
Oh, I submitted it 9 months ago. I'm still waiting for my results.
Yeah, they take their time. They're just reading it very carefully because how much they love it. They keep rereading it and rereading it because of how much they love it.
I've moved on.
Oh, bless. So, you know, stuff like this project with Janine about the hidden histories and the hidden archives and how that's steeped in legacies of sexism and racism, and trying to set Overland up to be an organisation where we can support a whole wide range of storytellers, you know, so we can get rid of the age restrictions on emerging prizes. There's all of these different activities, and absolutely in my brain they are situated as, well, this is what is my responsibility to do because my book was treated favourably in a way that it would not have been treated favourably if I were an older black woman, or if it were released, you know, 10 years ago, or if, you know, I were darker skinned. All of these contexts, I'm aware of them. And so those acts of refusal and reminding and, you know, re-establishing opportunities that are properly inclusive, that just to me is directly in response to the privileges that I've had. And I think these burdens of responsibility should not just be held by black fellas as well. Like, we were taught to act this way because we come from a sustainable culture and a culture that is the longest continuing culture on earth. But, you know, we've been talking about this stuff for long enough that I would hope that others have learnt now that that's something, that that's an initiative they can take themselves. If you've been brought forward, who are you bringing with you?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I grew up on a river, and my nanny used to say the river is the church, the archive, the school and the library, all in one. We have about 7 minutes left, no, six now, according to the Western clock. So would you like to, are you all right to take some questions? Yeah, I think we can take, you know, maybe one or two questions.
They're panicking.
Yeah. Stunned into silence.
Somebody
okay, thanks.
The front and then we...
And then there's one up the back too. Yeah, go.
Hi. Fascinating talk, thanks. I just wondered if traditionally memory work is done by women, or whether it's gender related, whether it's done by men and women or women's area of expertise, responsibility?
I mean, I'm not sure. Are you talking about like traditionally, like before colonisation? Because everyone was and is involved in memory work, you know. I think the idea of this like really strict gendered idea that women were this and men were that, I think they were heavily influenced by, you know, the white repressed archaeologists who were observing and writing down these things.
And
you know,
anthropologists.
But yeah. I think if we get rid of the whole traditional contemporary thing and we just look at what's happening and what's been happening, because it's on a continuum, you know, affected by history, but it's all related. I think a lot of the people that we're talking and citing in our conversation are women and non-binary people, but there are also men who are doing this work as well in their own way. Certainly we did have gendered business, men's business, women's business, but increasingly there's so many of us who are neither or a bit of both, and everyone's doing their own kind of memory work. I really think that to be a black fella today and to be working in the arts in some capacity, you are doing memory work. And yeah, there's plenty of fellas and you know, agender or non-gender people as well. I don't know, what do you think?
No, I agree with that 100%. And, you know, Janine mentioned the anthropologists there, and they would frequently privilege the perspectives and the insights of men in ways that really honestly just are astonishingly stupid to me, because the idea of there being different cultural roles and different knowledges, that's not something we invented. Like, no. You know, they would have been informed by anthropological, archaeological traditions and practices that were rooted in traditions where, you know, the majority of the educating was done by women, and women were in, you know, in different spaces than men were, and women had the children with them and were educating the children in particular ways. So, you know, to me it's just kind of the bulk of that anthropological work being predicated on assumptions, and Daisy Bates is exactly one of those individuals who is rooted in those assumptions, is pretty bizarre to me, and just really betrays the fact that the emphasis of heteropatriarchy, even to the deficit of the methods and the research methodologies required to substantiate heteropatriarchy in different colonial art posts, is just really, it's just such a bad idea. Of course there's different cultural roles and such, and women, you know, women play quite specific ones in the communication of some knowledges, but also so did and continue to do men, and we learn different things. The thing I'll say, though, not about gender but about age, is that the role of grandparents is very, very key, and the role of extended families is very, very key, and that's been one of the most extensive violences of the continuing stolen generations and continually increasing removals of Aboriginal children, having predicated on a refusal to understand the complexities of Aboriginal kinship networks and recognising that different family members have different roles in a child's life. And so if your kid's sleeping at your auntie's place that night, it does not mean that you are not responsible for that child. It actually is an interconnected structure. And so the complexities of those kinship systems have been used violently against us, and I think that that might go some way in the way of contextualising why a lot of Aboriginal people are super hesitant to speak about the cultural roles of different family members, whether that be by gender or by age. We've seen them weaponised against us, so I think, you know, I instinctively feel hesitation when being asked to comment on any aspect of our ongoing traditional cultural roles and such, because we've seen the anthropologists misrepresent
them. But also culture
them.
Changes.
And also culture is dynamic.
Like I'm working on this project in conversation with my uncle, who taught me so much cultural and historical business and political business. We were very close, you know. And me writing this and kind of making our relationship public goes against some of these, like, you know, oh, black matriarchy over here and then the men's business over here. Well, it wasn't like that in my family. We didn't have the choice, you know. I've never been part of a black matriarchy. I never knew my grandmothers, you know. So we also have to acknowledge that culture is dynamic and changes and responds to the circumstances that the government has made for
That's
us.
That's how sustainability arises. It arises out of the needs, you know. know, and responses to the needs as opposed to overarching rules that misinterpret the complexities. Yeah. Did you want to answer that at all, do you think?
No, I think you did that quite well, other than to say, like, when people came looking for the Antipodes, speaking of those misconceptions, when people came looking for the Antipodes from the Northern Hemisphere, they were looking for everything that was the opposite of, you know,
degeneracy.
So, yeah, they already had already informed themselves about what they were going to write even before they got here, really. So, yeah, part of what memory work under is to do, to undo that. I think there's one more question up the back there.
Sorry, I was just going to ask a question because I thought no one was asking a question.
Thank you.
But look, all hail to your amazing and wonderful work. My question, I suppose, is as a non-Indigenous woman, what can I do to help? I would just want to listen up to the stories that you're gathering.
Read them.
Yeah, I said buy our books, but same thing. I think if you just need to, like, as you said, if you want to support our stories, it's spread. If you enjoy our stuff, share it. I don't know. It depends how much power you have in that in a capacity. You know,
are you a feudal lord by chance? Because we might have another.
Are you a publisher? Do you own Twitter? You know, or are you somebody who is part of a book club, or, you know, are you a teacher? Can you set reading? Yeah, there's things you can do.
That's a serious answer. Like, read them and not read representations of First Nations people by anyone other than First Nations people.
One small thing that I see a lot of people doing, there's a lot of campaigns going around like Buy Black for Christmas or something like that, and, you know, trying to ensure that as much as possible that there is an investment in Black intellectual property, whether that be our art or our literature or our, you know, different forms of creative and critical practice. Investing in that, you know, financially is important. But the other thing, if people are really interested or want to feel like they can have a clear sense of purpose, Google Pay the Rent. I'm not exactly sure what the hyperlink of it is, but Pay the Rent has really detailed resources and guidelines on what different community actions or organisations or petitions or campaigns you can get behind. There's all manner of fundraising collectives and such. And that can be a really powerful demonstration because it's about recognising that actually the campaigns are already out there. We don't need to be reinventing the wheel here. So Pay the Rent is a great first place for people to try and look at what resources are out there for exactly that question of how do I help? And sometimes it's not financially, sometimes because understandably, like, you know, we're in a very difficult financial period for a lot of people. That doesn't always have to have a dollar amount attached to it, but petitions. The new CEO of GetUp has just been appointed, and that's an incredible Bundjalung woman, Larissa Roberts. And, you know, I think we're
Baldwin. Is
well,
it?
She's oh, she, oh Larissa yeah. Baldwin Roberts. You okay, know, yeah, she's yeah. a Roberts. I know all her mob. Yeah, don't yeah, worry, yeah, Lismore yeah. Roberts, Lismore Roberts. And it's an incredible, like, she's an incredible campaigner and organizer for Black social justice and environmental rights in particular. So jump on GetUp and sign up to their newsletters to hear what Larissa's doing and how individuals can get involved with that as well.
And the Indigenous Literacy Foundation can donate to that as well. Unfortunately, I think we're out of time. So, can we say thank you to Michaela and Ellen?
And thank you, Janine.
And to Janine.
Thanks for listening. This series was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which we work. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders past and present. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.